So here we are. This is the second lecture in chapter 4. Chapter 4 is on demand and supply. And I'm going to backtrack just a little bit. What we talked about last time was the demand curve, and what I'm going to talk about this time is the supply curve, and then I'm going to put the two together and talk about the market price. But just backtracking a little bit about the demand curve, when we change price, you've got to remember that we always assume that nothing else changes. So when we change price, then we're moving along a stationary demand curve. Now, what can cause a change in the demand curve? Well, what can cause a change is in the a change in some non-price determinant. Okay, they're called things that can change demand, which means that the whole curve shifts. So we talked about this last time, so I'm not going to go into it again, but the more people you have in the market, then there's a tendency for demand to increase. The fewer people in the market, there's a tendency for demand to decrease. A change in people's income, meaning real income, can change the demand for goods and services. Prices related goods and services can change. Expectations can change. Demographics can change. Consumer tastes can change. You see, if any of these six things change, then the whole curve will either shift to the right or shift to the left. We say that there's a change in demand when the whole curve shifts. If price changes, then we don't say there's a change in demand. We say there's a change in the quantity demanded. Because when price changes, demand itself does not change. In order for demand to actually shift, these are six things that can cause a shift in demand curves. So what is supply? Now this is new material. A relation showing the quantities of a good producers are willing and able to sell at various prices during a given time period, other things constant. So this is really the same definition as with supply, except we're talking about producers here. We're talking about suppliers. I could have said suppliers and not producers. And again, notice at the end it says other things constant, which means that what the supply curve shows us is how many units will be supplied as measured on the horizontal axis when price changes, and assuming that nothing else changes. Okay, we always make that assumption when we change price. Okay, with something we call ceteris paribus sometime. I mean, that's a Latin term, which means, everything else being the same, or something like that. What is a supply curve? A curve showing the quantities of a good supplied at various prices, other things constant. Again, same as demand curve, but we're talking here about the supply curve. And the law of supply, the quantity of a product supplied in a given time period is usually directly related to its price. Now, what does that mean, directly related? That means when price goes up, the quantity supplied goes up. Now, before I even get into this, that just makes sense. Okay? How do we know 100% with 100% certainty that if you look at a supplier of something and the price goes up, that supplier will make more money? Now, how can we say that for certain with 100% certainty? Because when we changed price, we assumed that nothing else changed. So if you owned a business and the price of whatever it is that you're supplying increased on the market and nothing else changed, I mean, your costs stayed the same, everything, Nothing changed here. The only thing that's happened is the price of your product has gone up in the market. Now, wouldn't you make more money? Yes. You see, you could make more money, assuming that nothing else changes, right, at those higher prices rather than the lower prices. And that's why supply curves have a positive slope. That's why when price goes up, the quantity supplied goes up because, well, suppliers have more incentive, right, to supply at higher prices because they can make more, they're making more money at those higher prices. See, the key word here is incentive. Suppliers do what they do because they have an incentive to do this or do that. And a rise in the price of their product in the market gives the supplier more incentive to supply that thing. You know, when price goes down, well, less money is made. Therefore, suppliers have less incentive to supply. See, now that's just common sense. See, don't get all hung up with these curves and don't try to commit any of this to memory. Just think about it and it just makes sense, right? You look at it and you say, oh, well, yeah, of course, that makes sense. And then you understand this material, okay? So what is a change in the quantity supplied? A movement along a supply curve in response to a change in the price of the things constant. Again, same as with demand curve. And here we have a demand schedule because it's shown to us on a table instead of a graph. And here we're talking about supply. So notice here that as the price per quart goes down, what happens to the amount supplied? It's going to go down. See, what's happening to... to the price of oil today? I mean, well, gasoline, when you go to get gas for your car. Well, I mean, yeah, gas has been going down. Well, yeah, fracking is certainly part of the mix. If you don't know what fracking is, it's a way of extracting oil from deep down into the earth by pushing water and using pressure. And I mean, I don't understand, you know, the exact process, but the what? Yeah, yeah, it forces the oil out of the ground because of the pressure. And it's an alternative way to extract oil from the earth. Well, yeah, you're right in that at first, you know, that made more oil available. Supply, you know, goes up and now we're getting to how you put demand and supply together. But the when the supply increases of anything, then again we're talking about an increase in supply. Then if you look at demand as well, the price will go down. But what's happening here? Well, to add to this, Saudi Arabia and some of the other oil producing countries have lowered their price. For what reason? Well, they've lowered their price in order to put the fracking companies out of business. Because fracking is only profitable if the price of a barrel of oil is about $40. But now it's down to closer to $20 a barrel. Because Saudi Arabia has increased the supply of oil so much, forced the price down. And, of course, what's the name of the game? Well, once they can drive these American companies out of business, yeah, then they'll raise prices. I mean, that's just part of macroeconomics, all right? That's just the way the game is played. Now, there are laws against that in the United States, you know, antitrust laws, but it is a common, but there is no international law. And so, you know, it is a common way. If you've got market power, then you can drive your competitors out of business by lowering your prices because maybe you've got what is called deep pockets. That's a term used in economics, deep pockets, which means that you've got lots of money, and so you can lower your price, drive your competitors out of business, because you can survive longer than they can at the lower prices. So you're losing money, but so are they, but you can hold on longer than they can, so once they go out of business, then that gives you more market power, and then you can raise your price easier and make more money. That's just the way, you know, the name of the game. You know, it's like Uber, the company, you know, ride-sharing business that's very popular in cities. Well, once a company like that becomes profitable, then all kinds of things happen. The government is now imposing taxes that it didn't before on Uber. They're coming out with more regulations against Uber. And partly, why? Because you've got the taxi service industry that has a lobbying presence in D.C., and they're influencing legislation. Because why? Uber is a competitor to the taxi service. See? So the whole point here is that all these forces come against Uber, and you know, whether it survives or not is really questionable. Okay? But that's, Sam, what I'm trying to convey to you, I'm trying to make this material as real life as I can. You know, you can talk about demand supply, but if you can't relate these principles to what's happening in the world today, then what good is this material? So that's really, you know, my main point, that my main objective here, that you really, because you're taking this course, you've got a better understanding of how things work and why they work the way they do in the world. So anyway, here we have a upward sloping supply curve, and now notice, see, when the price goes down, does supply change? Well, if you look at that supply curve, when price goes down, you will notice that supply does not change. That red supply curve does not move when price goes down. What does change? Well, what changes is down here on the horizontal axis, right? So, what we say is that when price changes, the quantity demanded changes, but not demand itself. Supplier. I mean, the same thing applies to demand curves, but now we're talking about supply. But it's the same concept. When price changes, the supply curve does not change, or we might say supply does not change. Well, what does change? Well, when price changes, the quantity supplied changes as measured on the horizontal axis. Now, notice here that when the price goes down, the quantity supplied goes down. Why? Because suppliers have less incentive to supply at the lower prices because they're making less money. How do we know they're making less money as price goes down, as the market price goes down? Because when we changed the price, we assumed that nothing else changed. Therefore, based on that assumption, we know that when the market price goes down, suppliers will make less money, and therefore they will have less incentive to supply at the lower prices. Now, isn't that just common sense? Okay. Now, there's other explanations of why supply curves have a positive slope, but I think that's the most straightforward one, the most, you know, one that you can just see, because it's just plain common sense. Now, what we're going to talk about next, as we did with demand, is shifts in supply curves. But before we get to that, we have to backtrack a little bit and just establish some vocabulary. So one bit of vocabulary is a relevant resource. What are relevant resources? Resources used to produce the good in question. See, a relevant resource, companies that use a certain resource to produce, those resources are relevant to that business. And since businesses differ, then change in prices affects some businesses more than others, depending upon what has changed in price. I mean, what's relevant to one business is not relevant to another business. Like if you owned a restaurant, then a change in the price of food, you know, you have to buy food from your wholesaler, and like around this area, it'd be Sysco, probably, or if you're buying meat, you might buy your meat and other products from Boar's Head. But I mean, if prices of those foods changed, then that's a relevant resource for you. Where if you owned a manufacturing company, then the price of food is not a relevant resource. You know, a change in the price of food would not affect your business. Okay? So, what are alternative goods? Other goods that use some of the same types of resources used to produce the good in question. So, in other words, almost everything has substitutes. If a good uses the same resources, but it can substitute those for other resources, that those would be alternative goods. See, important. Know the difference between a change in the quantity supplied and a change in supply. So, you know, this is the same with we had with demand. So what is a change in supply? A shift in a given supply curve caused by a change in one of the non-price determinants of the supply of the good. So again, if something changes other than price, the whole curve is going to shift. Now, what can cause a change in supply or service? A change in... Now, these are the five, you know, for demand curves, we had six reasons that would cause a shift in demand, but now we've got five reasons that can cause a shift in supply. So technology can change. See, what has happened to the supply of iPhones? Well, that's increased a lot. You know, the iPhone is a relatively new invention. And so because technology changed, the supply of iPhones has increased, but what has happened to the supply of landline phones? Decreased. You know, I mean, a lot of people, I know a few people still have landlines. I mean, I don't have a landline. I gave mine up long ago. Oh, wait a minute. No, say it again.
They have the landline commercial right now where yeah. The girl calls on cell phone and says, don't worry, baby, and she comes to you at the address, the cell phone breaks up, and the operator has to call back on the landline.
Yeah, well, that's actually, my sister has a cell phone, and she also has a landline for that reason. And what he's saying here is that if you need to call 911 without... You know, and for them to know your location, it used to be, anyway, that a landline would be much more beneficial. But, you know, with our present GPSs, I'm not sure if that's true anymore. I mean, GPS is it's pretty amazing. And I don't think that I do believe that that's radically changing. But the point here, the only point I'm making is that when there's a change in technology, then there's going to be an increase in supply of some things and a decrease in supply of other things. You know, with when like at one time, mathematicians would use a slide rule to do certain mathematical computations, calculations. Well, how many people use slide rules today? Why? None. Because there's been a change in technology. So the supply of slide rules have, I mean, most of you may not even know what a slide rule is, but the but it's something that, that you know, is no longer, there's no longer supply of. It's like typewriters. I mean, who would think, you know, 20 years ago that a typewriter would be totally an antique? Yeah, it'd be non-existent. I mean, typewriters were so ubiquitous to our lives not that many years ago. And then the computers came in, and of course, the computer now has totally replaced the typewriter. And so, you know, there's been an increase. So what's happened to the supply of typewriters? Well, it, you know, it shifted so far to the left that it's gone off the page. It's gone. So so that's a change in technology, can change supply of some things and decrease the supply of other things. Prices of relevant resource. Now, a relevant resource is, again, it's that, you know, what resources does a business use that is relevant to its business? So, like for a cattle farmer, if the price of fertilizer goes up, what's going to happen to the supply of cattle? Well, it's going to go down because people who raise cattle, their expenses go up and they can't raise as many cattle as before because of the higher prices, higher costs. Well, fertilizer would be a relevant resource for that cattle farmer, but it wouldn't be a relative resource for, let's say, a person who owns a restaurant. See? So if there's a change in the price of a relevant resource, some resource that's relevant to this business, then supply curves will change for this business or this industry. Prices of alternative goods can change. So there are always these substitutes. Alternative good is, well, we can use this or we can use that. So if there's a change in the price of an alternative good, either it goes up or down, then that will change the supply of the first good, the good in question. Because, you know, if two goods are related, and one is a substitute for the other, and, you know, let's, you know, take goods A and B, and the price of A goes way up. Well, if the price of A goes way up, what will people do? Yeah, they'll use more of B, right? So when prices of alternative goods increase, then that will affect the supply of the first good in question. And as like with demand curves, expectations can change. Expectations is a powerful force. You know, since no one can foretell the future for sure, suppliers make decisions based on their expectations of future events. So no matter what the present situation is, if supplier thinks that tomorrow is going to be better than today, then they may increase the supply. Because, see, it takes time to increase supply anyway. I mean, you know, if a business wants to increase supply, they might have to build, you know, onto their factory, or they might have to buy more machines or better machines. They might have to hire more workers. See, but all this takes time. So they have to base their decision on what they think is going to happen in the future. And if they think the future, I mean, things could be going great in the present, but if suppliers think that the future is going to be worse than the present, then they will be less willing to supply. Supply will go down. See, things are great. Well, how come supply went down? Because the thinking, the expectations of suppliers have changed. Okay, and this could be for, well, many different reasons. Some might be concrete reasons, and others may be just, yeah, I mean, just expectations. Just, you know, really no concrete reason except, well, you know, rumors can get started. Rumors, you know, I think YouTube is, YouTube has affected people's expectations. But the thing with YouTube is that anyone can put up anything on YouTube. So you get a lot of people with these wild ideas, and they put out a YouTube video, and it becomes popular. And so other people say, you know, this thing grows. And then, well, other people get on the bandwagon, and they put out videos on the same vein. And, you know, those become popular. And next thing you know, you got a bunch of videos on a certain topic. And it may or may not be valid, but this affects people's expectations. And when you change people's expectations, it can change the supply. You know, if you look at YouTube, I mean, you'd think that the world's going to come to an end, you know, starting today. The 28th was a key date. Now, if you look at a lot of these YouTube videos, well, what do you suppose, you know, because of all this negative, these negative expectations of the future, what do you suppose has happened to the supply of things like dry-freed food? You know, people buying more food that, you know, in preparation of a complete economic collapse, and, you know, the demand or the, you know, the people that could go into that business, they said, wow, all these people are going to buy our product because they're fearful of a total economic collapse, and so, you know, we'll go into the business of freeze-dried food. See, the supply, you know, therefore the supply increases. Anyway, I find that interesting. Number of producers in the market, that's like the demand curve. The more suppliers you have in the market, then there's a tendency for supply to increase. Now, notice I use the word tendency. See, if there's more suppliers, do we know that supply will increase? Well, we don't know for certain that supply will increase. But we do know that the more suppliers you have in the market, then there's a tendency for supply to increase. You know, we do this a lot in economics. You know, we very rarely can we take a definite stand. Can we say, if this changes, this will be the result? See, we can't hardly ever say that. But what we can say in economics is that, well, you know, based on the past and based on our understanding of how economics works, when this changes, there's a tendency for this or that to happen. See, that's what, you know, that's where you got to think as an economist. Okay? So it's not absolute, even though some economists like to make economics into an exact science. It will never be an exact science, because it deals with people, and people are emotional, and, you know, what can be good news one day can be bad news the next day. I mean, it's just, and sometimes there's just no explanation for it. You know, I remember in times past, Apple, for example, a couple years ago, I remember that the Apple showed an increase in profits of, like, very generous, like it was like 10 or 12% over the previous year. And you think, wow, that's a great growth rate. People would buy more of that company stock. Well, instead of the stock price going up, it went down. Why did the price go down? Because investors were expecting, like, a much higher increase in sales. You know, like they were expecting a 20% increase in sales, but sales increased only, you know, 8 or maybe 10%. So even though it's a 10% would be a phenomenal increase in sales, because it's less than the investors expected, they sold more stock than they bought, and the price went down. I mean, sometimes these things, you know, it defies logic. Yeah. But it's all based on expectations. You know, that like in the example I gave you, that when the price of Apple, when the stock price went down, it was because of expectations. When the price went down, despite a big increase in sales, price went down because of investors' expectations. Yeah, they expected more. They expected a greater increase in sales, and therefore they were disappointed with only a 10% increase. See, what happens when we put demand and supply together? We get equilibrium. Now, you know, we're done with the supply. We talked about demand. Now, then we talked about supply. Now I'm going to put the two together, and we're going to talk about the market price. Now, in order for you to understand the market price, you've got to understand a very key concept, and that concept is the concept of equilibrium. Now, there are different ways to explain what equilibrium is, but the way I like to use is an equilibrium is a tendency toward. Equilibrium is a point toward which the economy tends. Okay? It's a tendency toward. Now, the example I like to use is the pendulum is of a grandfather clock. Now, if you can picture a grandfather clock and picture that pendulum swinging back and forth, all right, as that pendulum swings back and forth, at what point is that pendulum ultimately tending toward? Well, it is ultimately tending toward the midpoint. Well, yeah, the middle. You know, it goes so far to the left, and then it goes back to the right, and then it goes so far to the right, and then it starts going back to the left. But, you know, as it swings back and forth, see, what point is it ultimately tending toward? Well, it's tending toward the midpoint. See? Now notice this. If you measured the time that this pendulum took to swing from one extreme to the other extreme, what percent of that time would it actually be at the midpoint? And the answer is a very small fraction of the time, right? That total time as it swings from the right to the left, only a small fraction of that time is it actually at the midpoint. And get this. At least half the time, the pendulum is moving away from the midpoint, right? See? It's moving, you know, moves this way, then it moves that way, right? So, here's a midpoint where the pendulum is only at for a small fraction of the time. It's moving away from this point half the time. But what is the point? It's an equilibrium. Why? Because it's the point toward which the pendulum tends toward. And that's the concept of the equilibrium. It's a tendency toward something. It's not when two things are equal. You know, if things are in equilibrium, that doesn't mean that two things are equal. It means that this is a point toward which the economy tends. Okay? So that concept is very important. See, an equilibrium is a point toward which the economy tends. And a disequilibrium, now that what the term disequilibrium means is that the economy is at a point other than the equilibrium. That's what disequilibrium means. The economy is somewhere other than the equilibrium point. So what is a surplus? A surplus is an excess quantity supplied over quantity demanded at a given price. That's what it means by surplus, that more units are being supplied than being demanded. That would give us a surplus. Sometime in economics we call it an Well, in terms of manufacturing, we would call it excessive inventory.
Overstock.
Yeah, overstock or excessive inventory. You know, all businesses need inventory, meaning that, you know, they produce something but they haven't sold it yet. So almost all businesses need inventory. But when that inventory becomes excessive, then you can get a surplus. See, why is a surplus a disequilibrium? When there is a surplus, the supplier will lower the price to get rid of the surplus. And we got a picture of this. What is a shortage? I'm going to rush through this a little bit till we get to the graph. Shortage is an excess quantity demanded over the quantity supplied at a given price. So more units are being demanded than being supplied at a given price. That's what we call a shortage. So why is a shortage a disequilibrium? When there is a shortage, consumers will bid up the price, determine who gets and who does not get. And what is market equilibrium? The condition that exists in a market when the plans of the buyers match the plans of the sellers. And here is a picture, and now I'll just go back and explain, you know, the previous slides. All right, this one picture sums up everything we've covered in Chapter 4. Notice here we got a downward slope in demand curve, and we talked about why demand curves have downward slopes. And we got a positive slope supply curve. The supply curve slopes upward, and we just talked about why supply curves slope upward, correct? Now, notice that the demand curve intersects the supply curve at 75 cents. Now, if I were to ask you, where is the equilibrium, or what is the equilibrium price, then you would say 75 cents, because that's where quantity demand equals quantity supply. But if I were to ask you why 75 cents is an equilibrium, then you've got more of an involved answer. And here's the answer. Now, I'm going to ask you a question, then, but I'm going to answer it myself. See, the question is, why is 75 cents the equilibrium price? And here's the answer. Because if you go above 75 cents, you will get a surplus. Now, how come? Well, as the price goes up, what do demanders say to themselves? Well, they say, hey, we don't want to buy as much at the higher prices as we did at the lower prices. But as the price goes up, what do suppliers say to themselves? Well, suppliers say, hey, we want to supply more at the higher prices than at the lower prices, because we have more incentive to supply more, correct? Because as the prices go up, we can make more money, right? And we can say that because we assumed here that everything else stayed the same when we changed price. So as price goes up above 75 cents, demanders say we don't want as much, suppliers say we want to supply more, and so what happens? Well, as supply increases, the quantity supply increases, demand decreases, pretty soon we get a surplus. We get more units being supplied than being demanded. So now what happens? Well, suppliers are going to say, oh, we got to get rid of the surplus, so let's lower the price. Now, Let's take a clothing store, for example. Let's say a clothing store is selling, you know, suits. And the price of a suit is, let's say that the cost of the suit is $300. That's what the company pays for it. And they're trying to sell the suit for $500. Now, no one buys these suits for $500, or very few people do. Now, what's the store owner going to do? Well, he's going to lower the price, you know, maybe by $50. Okay, maybe he'll sell a few more, but not really too many people are interested. See, now, he might lower the price again, maybe by $100, and he'll sell more. Now, what did I say? I said, I'm taking this out of my mind, but I said that the cost of the suit was $300, right? He was trying to sell the suit originally for $500.
But now you're at a $50 profit.
Yeah, but now what happens if at $300 price, he still can't sell very many suits? So would this store owner, retailer, lower the price to, let's say, $250? Now, it cost him $300 to buy the suit. Would he lower the price to $250? And the answer is, well, sure. And you might say, well, at $250, he's losing $50 on each suit. Yeah, but if you keep the price at higher, then you won't sell the suit. And for every suit you don't sell, you lose $300. But if you lower the price to $250, you'll lose and you can sell the suit, then you'll lose $50 per suit. Well, would you rather not lower the price and lose $300 a suit, or lower the price and lose $50 a suit? Right? So what the retailer paid for the suit is really irrelevant. I mean, the only thing that's relevant here is, are you going to sell it or are you not? Because if you don't sell it, you've lost all the money you've put into it. So see, the point I'm making here is that when there's a surplus, the supplier will lower the price. Just like in the story with the suits. You know, step by step. Maybe not a whole lot at one time, but you lower the price, don't sell enough, lower the price, still don't sell enough, see what I mean? That's the way it goes. Now, things in life don't just come to an abrupt stop. What's going to happen is a price is going to fall down and it's going to go right below 75 cents. But as it goes below 75 cents, what happens? Well, see, as the price goes down, what do demanders say to themselves? Oh, we want to buy more. What do suppliers say to themselves? Oh, we want to supply less. So eventually, you're going to get a shortage where the quantity demanded is greater than the quantity supplied at these low prices. So when there's a shortage in a free market, and that's what we're talking about here, a free market, how does the market decide who gets and who doesn't get? Well, that's where the price mechanism comes in, right? The price goes up, and those that can afford it, and those who want it the most, well, they get. And those who can't afford it or don't want it as much don't get. And that's how we solve what is called the allocation problem, you know, who gets and who doesn't get. So when there's a shortage, the market dictates a higher price as people bid one another, like at an auction, and they bid prices up. And those who get are those who want it the most and have the money to pay for it. Okay? So, price goes up back toward 75 cents. Now, what have I shown you here? I've shown you that if price is more than 75 cents, price will come down. If price is less than 75 cents, price will go up. So what's 75 cents? That's an equilibrium. Why? Because that's the price toward which the economy tends. Okay? Now, what causes an increase in equilibrium price, an increase in demand, or a decrease in supply? Now, here, demand, supply, equilibrium is at 75 cents, right? That's the equilibrium. But what happens if, oh gracious, what happens if demand shifts to the right And remember, if any of these six non-price determinants change, there will be a shift in demand, correct? Well, if demand increases, what happens to the equilibrium price? It goes up. What happens to the equilibrium quantity? It goes up as well. Or this can happen. Equilibrium, let's say, starts out at 50 cents. But the supply curve shifts to the left. What happens to the equilibrium price? It goes up. What happens to equilibrium quantity? It goes down. Now, what happens again? Equilibrium is at a dollar. Demand goes down. What happens to equilibrium price? It goes down. What happens to equilibrium quantity? It goes down. Now, you may have some questions on the test like this. And all you need to come to the correct answer is a third grade ability to draw. You don't have to know a thing. See, downward sloping demand curve, upward sloping supply curve. Price is always on the vertical axis, quantity is always on the horizontal axis. If the question says demand goes down, what happens to the equilibrium price? Well, you just draw it. Yeah, you just draw it and look what happens. And the answer jumps up out of the page and hits you in the face. See, simple. Okay, you don't even have to understand it to come up with the correct answer. But it's better that you understand it. So, here we got different scenarios. I'm kind of trying to rush through these because I want to get to the end point. But here supply increases a lot. And here demand increases a lot. Supply increases a little because demand and supply can change at the same time. And again, all you got to do is draw it. You know, if demand increases more than supply, then that's the same thing as me saying that demand increases. Right? If a question on a test says that demand increases relative to supply, then you just read that as an increase in demand because that's what's happened. See, you don't have to think, oh, I got two things happening here. Demand's changed, supply changed. Well, it's the same thing as demand's changed, period.
Well, relative.
Well, it's always relative, too. See, here, demand has changed more relative to a change in supply. So the net effect would be the same as if I just said that demand increased. Okay, and this is a picture of why that's true. Anyway, I'd want to, these are just different examples of what can happen because in life, change is inevitable. But what I've only got about 5 minutes, and I want to talk about price floors and price ceilings. See, what is a price floor? A minimum legal price below which a good or service cannot be sold. For example, the minimum wage. There's a lot of cities, the federal government has increased the federal minimum wage, and there's lots of cities that are, like Los Angeles and San Francisco, that are increasing the minimum wage in those cities. Now, will an increase in a minimum wage cause unemployment? Well, I ask you a question, and the first thing that should pop out of your mouth is that all depends. See, there is no argument here. There is no differences of opinion. There's only mathematics. Okay? Here's the point I'm making. If wages, you can look at a certain area. If wages in that area are below the equilibrium wage, then if we increase wages, that will not affect unemployment. In other words, notice here that at the equilibrium where demand equals supply, Everyone who wants to work has a job. Demand equals supply, right? So you've got no unemployment here, all right? Now, if the minimum wage is below, I mean, if the minimum wage is below the equilibrium wage, then if we increase the wage, what happens? Well, we're still going to get full employment. See, we can raise the wage and still have full employment. But if in a certain area, which could be the whole United States, people are making the minimum wage, the equilibrium wage, and the government says, no, we're not satisfied with that. We want a higher wage. So they raise it, and this ought to be like maybe $10.10 an hour instead of $6. I should change that. What's going to happen? Well, as the wage goes up above the equilibrium wage, we're going to have a surplus. And what's a surplus? Workers. So if you increase the wage above the equilibrium wage, you are going to get more unemployment. Now, you've got winners and you've got losers. Some people will make a higher wage than they would otherwise, but some people won't have a job where they would have a job at the lower wage. So, see, will the minimum wage cause unemployment? That all depends. It depends on where the wage is in the first place. Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. The price equilibrium. That's the whole key. If wages are below the equilibrium wage, then an increase in the minimum wage laws won't cause unemployment. But if the minimum wage law increases wages above the equilibrium wage, then the only possible thing can happen in terms of mathematics is we're going to get more unemployment. See, on that, there's no disagreement here. It's just mathematics. All right? Of course, the key is, do we know what the equilibrium wage is, right? I mean, that's easier said than done in terms of, well, what is it? But, I mean, in terms of economics, if you say, oh, well, we know what the equilibrium wage is, then we can say for certain what effect a change in the wage laws will have. Now, here's another one. I got just a few minutes. What is a price ceiling? A maximum legal price above which a good or service cannot be sold. So, like rent control. Maybe the equilibrium rent is up here, where demand equals supply, the demand for rental property versus supply rental property. If the government says, well, we think that rent is too high, and they lower the rent below the equilibrium rent, then what has got to happen? Well, what's got to happen is we're going to have a shortage. Because as price goes down, suppliers say, we don't want to supply as much. Demanders say, we want more, so we're going to have more demand being demanded than being supplied. And we're going to have a shortage. Now, in a free market, the price would go up. But this is not a free market now with rent control. So with rent control, we're saying that we are going to have a permanent shortage of rental property. Now, again, you got winners and you got losers. Those who are living in rental properties that are well taken care of and paying a lower rent, they're winners. But people who are looking for rental property but can't find rental property because there's a shortage, well, they're losers. Okay, and other losers are people who are living in rental of a property that's not being well taken care of because rents are so low that can't cover the cost of the landlord, of the rental property. Now, here's my final point. How could we have more rental property at lower prices? We could have more rental property at lower prices if we lowered the costs to suppliers, like taxes and government regulations. If we lower taxes and government regulations, what's going to happen to the supply curve? It's going to shift to the right. If it shifts to the right, what happens? Well, we get more rental property at lower rent. Okay? And why don't we do this? Because it's politically unpopular. See, if our politician, and I say, look, you vote me into office, and I'll lower taxes on these landlords, these renters, people who rent rental property, a lot of people wouldn't vote for me because say, well, you're just favoring, you know, the rich, you know, people who own rental property. But if I come to you and say, look, if you vote me in office, I'll pass rent control and I'll force these people who have rental property to lower their rents, you think I'm on your side. But what happens? Well, what happens is, you know, we get shortages, and, you know, the number one reason for slums in these big cities is rent control, because landlords don't have the incentive to keep their properties up. And we have less, so we get dilapidated properties, and we have shortages because of rent control. Now, again, that's only true if rent control lowers rents below the equilibrium. Okay, that's why you got to know where the equilibrium is. Well, we've run out of time. See, that is the end, so this was a pretty good timing. So this finishes chapter 4, and so what are y'all going to do for next time? Read chapter 5, right? So I'll see you all next time for chapter 5.